you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
I know I'd go from rags to riches if you would only say you care. And though my pocket may be empty, I'd be a millionaire.
Young Tony Bennett, Rags to Riches, from the soundtrack of the motion picture Goodfellas, directed by Martin Scorsese and starring Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, and Ray Liotta, who passed away Thursday at the age of 67. It's Film Week on KPECC. A little bit later, we'll talk about Ray Liotta's cinematic legacy. Of course, Goodfellas, the film that really put him on the map with his signature performance, coming out of Field of Dreams, playing Shoeless Joe Jackson. But let's get to this week's new films. I'm joined by critics Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the YouTube and podcast series Breakfast All Day, Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, and Wade Major of Cinegods.com. First up, more than 30 years after the original, it's Top Gun Maverick, starring Tom Cruise with Miles Teller, Jennifer Connelly, and John Hamm. Joseph Kosinski is the director, and the screenwriters are Aaron Kruger, Eric Warren Singer, and Christopher McQuarrie. Wade, please start us on Top Gun Maverick.
I am almost embarrassed to admit how much I actually like this. And I've tried to sort of psychoanalyze myself about it. And I think what it comes down to is that, 40 some years ago when the first film came out, I was an usher at the Man's National Theater. So I was on the ground when that film opened and the crowds flocked in, and I hated it. I thought it was dumb and pandering and just ridiculously lowbrow. And everything that I hated about that film, I now love about this film. So nostalgia and time have a very strange effect. And I think what it is, I don't think the original film was as bad as I thought it was at the time. And I don't think this film is really as good as it feels to a lot of us. But I do think there's a perfect storm of factors that are kind of all coalescing right now. And one of them is, in fact, the nostalgia factor. If you are roughly Tom Cruise's age, a little bit younger, or a little bit older, if you're from that generation, you're sort of living vicariously through him. You see the years ticking by, and he appears to be ageless, and he's doing these things. And, the flying is real flying this time. It wasn't in the original. And so you do feel as if somehow he represents something that is hopeful in life. And you combine that with coming out of the pandemic, the hope that this movie will help bring people back to movie theaters, the fact that this film was, postponed so many times during the last 2 years, that all of this now combines into this moment of hope. And it's personal hope, it's societal hope, it's aesthetic hope. And the fact that the film is good enough to sort of pass muster with all that, it's fine. It's, he comes back, he's never really become the military leader that they hoped for him to be. He's still a rebel. He's still Maverick. A lot of things from the first film aren't explained. We don't know where Kelly McGillis went, for example. Jennifer Connelly is now here. She's holding it down for the 50-something women like he is for the 50-something men. And they all look fabulous. And then he has to train a bunch of young pilots for a mission to some enemy country, which of course is unidentified because we can't offend anybody and hurt any foreign markets now. And they execute the mission and it's exciting and it's wonderful. And there are a couple of really great twists in it. And it works. It's perfectly fine for what it is. But all of this other stuff that we're living through, all this other stuff that we're sort of dealing with personally and generationally and in terms of the pandemic, it's just good enough to scratch all those itches. And for that reason, I think this thing is just going to be monstrous at the box office.
Top Gun Maverick. Christy.
I kind of loved it too. And I will readily acknowledge the hypocrisy in this, in that this Top Gun does everything I hated in the Ghostbusters reboot He just does it all really, really well. It shows you all the same stuff. I mean, the opening of this film is exactly the same as the opening of Top Gun, down to they're on the aircraft carrier playing Danger Zone. I mean, it's very nostalgia driven for sure, but it is executed so well from a pacing perspective, from a technical perspective, from the performances. Joseph Kosinski directed this, and it is absolutely thrilling. You truly do feel like you are in the plane with Tom Cruise pulling G's. And the sound design is totally immersive, and it's a beautifully made film. And it's an opportunity to see Tom Cruise return to one of his most iconic roles, if not the iconic defining role of his career. And yet it's not beat for beat the Maverick that we know from 1986. I mean, yes, he is still swaggering. Yes, he still rides a motorcycle without a helmet. Yes, we have, you can do a checklist. You have the shirtless sporting activity. Here, it's not volleyball, it's football. And when that scene came up, I turned to the friend that I brought with me. I'm like, this right here is the reason this movie exists, so that Tom Cruise can play shirtless football at age almost 60 and show that he looks amazing. But, you know, he gets to evolve in ways that are interesting, in ways that reflect his age. There are some twists that you don't necessarily expect in this traditionally heroic journey. The supporting cast is pretty good. Jennifer Connelly is great. I like that he has an age-appropriate love interest. She is the aforementioned Admiral's daughter, if you have seen Top Gun recently. She's Penny. And Miles Teller is pretty good as Goose's son. Glenn Powell, if you didn't already know him, he is going to be a superstar based on this role alone. So yeah, it's all that nostalgia, but it's taking it to a whole nother level. And I agree with Wade that it's going to be monstrous, and it should be. You should go to the theater and see this.
Well, I want to ask you both, too, whether you think this will connect with younger moviegoers, because that is the bulk of the audience now. It might have been even pre-pandemic, but older moviegoers have been more reluctant to return. Is this going to get people, say, in their 20s or even teens out to theaters?
I think it will, because it's very smart and shrewd in understanding that it needs to play up this generational conflict. The fact that Tom represents this old guard, and then all these young guns think they're so hot and he's got to show them up. There's a little bit of something here for the 20 somethings and for the 50 somethings. Everybody gets to kind of beat their chest a little bit. There's a lot for women here, which is not always the case, for example, in Marvel movies, which are very, very male oriented. I mean, Top Gun always understood that its audience was first and foremost not young men, but young women. And I think in terms of going for that four quadrant strategy, it's been very, very smartly calculated. They have not strayed too far from the well. They've stuck close to formula, but just made it, you know, updated it just enough to really feel fresh. I think it's gonna hit on every single level.
What is the four quadrant strategy?
Oh, it's what is it? Old, young, male, female is how it roughly breaks down. But I think it's gonna. There's just everyone's gonna want to see this. I can't imagine anyone not wanting to go to a movie theater and see this.
Well, especially a film that the theater is gonna make a huge difference. This is not presumably, Christy, a movie you want to see at least first at home.
Oh, right. And also, as Tom Cruise said at Cannes, where this movie premiered boisterously, like, this was never going to stream. Like, he was never going to allow that to happen. And I think it's worth the wait. I also should have mentioned the Lady Gaga song, the big bombastic Lady Gaga theme. They weave that melody in really nicely throughout the film as a theme, sort of the way they did with Take My Breath Away in the original. But, you know, you hire Lady Gaga to do your Top Gun theme. You don't want her to go under the top. You want that big soaring ballad, and they work it in really well.
Top Gun Maverick, rated PG-13. Of course, it stars Tom Cruise. It's in wide release. The popular animated television series Bob's Burgers is now the Bob's Burgers movie. The film is directed by Lauren Bouchard and Bernard Derriman. It's also written by Bouchard and Jim Dodereve and Nora Smith. Christy, what'd you think of the Bob's Burgers movie?
Oh, it's so much fun. But I love Bob's Burgers. And so I knew going into it that I was going to have a good time, or I at least really, really hoped that I would. And if you are a fan of the show, it will definitely fulfill your expectations. I think it helps a great deal to know the show going in. You don't have to. You could still have fun. You could go into it cold and just enjoy the liveliness of it and how distinct the characters are and the sweetness of it and the weirdness of it. But it definitely helps if you are already a fan to know these characters, to know these voice actors. Unlike a lot of times where they take a TV show and make it into a full-length feature film, they do have all of the cast back to do their roles. So you have H. John Benjamin, Kirsten Shaw, Dan Mintz, John Roberts, Eugene Merman, even Kevin Klein comes to be, you know, Mr. Fish Odor, their landlord. And the plot is a very traditionally kind of Bob's Burgery plot where they get into misadventures and get into trouble, but it's always for the core value of saving the restaurant, saving the family, looking out for each other. There's a underlying decency and kindness to Bob's Burgers that really shines through here as well. The trouble that they get into is summer's coming, Memorial Day weekend's coming, they owe money for their rent on the restaurant, they're having trouble making payments, and what do you know, right exactly then, this giant sinkhole opens up right in front of the restaurant, and it makes it impossible for customers to get in. So this one big weekend that they needed to pay their rent, now they're looking like they're gonna be in trouble. Meanwhile, all three of the kids have crises of their own in terms of their identity, in terms of who they really think they want to be versus who they truly are meant to be. And they, you know, go on an adventure to try to figure out what happened with the sinkhole and the mystery behind it. It's really, really fun. And it looks great. Like it looks much more elaborate in the animation than watching the TV show. There's like a fluidity to it that maybe doesn't always exist on the show. It looks like a big screen version of television. And it's got a few songs. I kind of wish they had done a full-blown musical here, because so much of the joy of Bob's Burgers is in the musical numbers and the playfulness and the creativity of the lyrics. And there are three songs in this. So it's sort of like three episodes back to back to back, and each one has a song, but I kind of wish they'd gone like full-blown musical with it. But if you love this show, you're going to love this movie.
The Bob's Burgers movie, directed by the creator of the series, Lauren Bouchard, along with Bernard Derriman. The film's rated PG-13. The animated comedy adventure is in wide release. Chiara is an Italian drama that's written and directed by Jonas Carpignano. The film is in select theaters. Wade, please start us off on our Chiara.
Very, very good film. I don't think it's as good as Carpignano's previous two films. I still like his first film from about 7 years ago, Mediterranean, which is a powerful, immigration tale. But it's interesting, he's an Italian filmmaker, but born and raised in New York. People should know he's as American as he is Italian. But he's made his career in Italy, and he primarily tells these very, very pastoral, neorealist tales that kind of evoke a little bit of Claire Denis, the Dardenne brothers, a little bit of Matteo Garrone. He's kind of in that European mold of these films that feel so real and so intimate that you almost can't imagine a camera being anywhere near the characters when they're having their most intimate moments. This is a coming of age tale. It's about a 15-year-old girl, small town family. Her father, for whatever reason, winds up disappearing. And then it turns out that he's involved with the mafia. And this sort of sends her entire coming of age narrative into a tailspin. There's some really interesting legal stuff in here relating to families where if they are Italian crime families, there apparently are laws that allow them to separate children from these families so that they do not fall into the hereditary trap of perpetuating the crime family. So that plays a part in this as well. And this girl, Chiara, she has to somehow figure out who she is and how she's going to grow up and what kind of a life she's going to have now that she's been sucked into all of these events far beyond her ability to control. It's a little bit less about the actual story than it is just about the character and her emotions. And some of these scenes are really very uncomfortable, but it's beautifully shot and it's very smart. And I even though I think it's his third best film, he's made three very fine films.
We'll hear what Christie has to say about the Italian drama A Chiara when we come back. But I do want to remind you, in case you miss any of the reviews from the broadcast of Film Week, it's available in its entirety by just asking your smart speaker to play Film Week. It's also available at kpcc.org, or you can download it wherever you get your podcasts. You can control when you listen to Film Week and make sure you don't miss reviews on any of these films, especially the little gems that you might not hear about otherwise. The Italian film A Chiara will be followed by Japanese animated movie Fortune Favors Lady Mikuko. We'll hear about that from Charles. It all comes back in 1 minute.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
A little bit later on Film Week, we remember actor Ray Liotta, who died Thursday at the age of 67. He reportedly died in his sleep of apparently natural causes. He was in the Dominican Republic shooting an upcoming film, Dangerous Waters. Our critics remember Ray Liotta later this hour on Film Week. On the new Off-Ramp podcast from LAS Studios, besides showering together, one of the ways you can save water during the drought is to take shorter showers like they do in the Navy. And Sandon Totten, host of Brains On, is going to demonstrate just how to do that. Then Sandon talks with an astronaut to hear how they save water in space. Off-Ramp, wherever you get your podcasts. Just like Film Week, available as a podcast wherever you get your audio. I'm joined this week by film critics Wade Major, Charles Solomon, and Christie Lemire. We're right in the middle of a review of the Italian drama A Chiara. We just heard what Wade had to say. Christie, what are your thoughts on it?
I liked it a lot, too. I actually like this the best of these three Calabria set films from this director. It does have a lot of the same kind of neo-realistic streaks, it's hard to say, as the previous two films, and a reliance on regular people who are not necessarily actors to lead the way and really immerse us in this world. And so you have an entire family, you know, playing versions of themselves, I suppose. They are all the family who are starring as his family, but the young actress who stars as Chiara, Swami Rotolo, is a total find. She has this fantastic presence about her and this quiet calm in her eyes that can become really intense. And following her on this journey, this coming of age journey for her, as she investigates what her father is doing and comes to the shattering conclusion that this man that she loved and looked up to is not necessarily who she thought he was. It's really fascinating. One little tidbit about this is kind of interesting. Ben Zeitlin, who directed Beasts of the Southern Wild, did the music for this.
Oh.
Yeah.
Beasts had a great soundtrack.
Right. And so the music is clearly a big deal to him. So he did the music for this film here. But yeah, there is a bit of a cinematic universe going on here. If you have seen all three films, there are some connections here and there. But I never knew where it was going. I was gripped watching her repeatedly put herself in danger to find out the truth about her dad. And it's just so well done in a way that looks effortless. Like it's a lot of work to make a film like this look effortless. And he pulls it off once again.
Written and directed by Jonas Carpignano, A Chiara, set in Calabria, Italian drama. It's rated R, and it's available this week at the Lemley NoHo 7 Theater, and then it'll expand to multiple Lemley locations in a week. Film's rated R. Fortune Favors Lady Nikuko, a Japanese animated film directed by Ayuma Watanabe. Charles.
Well, this is a very different film and frankly a much better one than Watanabe's previous effort that was the rather incomprehensible Children of the Sea. This is a small domestic comedy drama. The title character, Nikuko, is brash and loud. She likes to eat. She likes to drink. She's kind of a caricature of what the Japanese say that people from Osaka are like. She even has the drawl that's their sort of regional dialect. Her daughter, Kikuko, is an intelligent child, a very mature one for her age. She's in middle school, who is negotiating her own problems of where does she fit into her school? What does she want to do? For the first time, she kind of likes a guy, and she has this mother who would be considered embarrassing if you were a junior high middle school student and a waitress who is a loud drinker, who's very heavy and vulgar, but warm-hearted, shows up. And it's about the two of them finding a way to, you know, establish their life together, for Kikuko to begin the establishment of her own identity. Not a perfect film, a little bit long maybe, but very charming, very warm, and a really welcome change from Wara Watanabe.
Fortune favors Lady Nikuko's unrated. For what ages would you say it's best suited, Charles?
Anyone from adolescent up. Certainly middle school students and high school students will feel an identity with Kikuko and, God, my parents are so awful, moments.
The film, again, directed by Ayuma Watanabe, Satomi Ushima is the screenwriter of the Japanese animated film Fortune Favors Lady Nikuko. It's in Japanese with subtitles, and it'll be in wide release starting June 2nd and in a limited theatrical run starting the day after that. Fire in the Mountains, an Indian drama, is directed and written by Ajit Pal Singh. Wade?
You know, a very impressive first-time film from the director. It's not a great film, but it's a very noble film. Basically, it's the story of a family in the foothills of the Himalayas, and they are struggling to make ends meet. It's not a happy marriage. They have two children. Their son can't walk, but not for any medical reason. It's for some psychological reason, and he has to be carried everywhere. And the mother, she struggles to save the money. The father is irresponsible and temperamental and sometimes abusive. And it's a look at what transpires on the fringes of what many people are calling the Indian economic revolution and economic miracle, that even though India has all of this progress, there are still people who live on the margins and continue to struggle. And you're aware of this because the daughter watches TikTok, and you hear things on the television and on the radio that talk about India's progress, but it never seems to trickle down to this family and their struggles. A lot of people might compare it to the films of Satyajit Ray, like Padre Panchali, which is Bengali, and this is Hindi, slightly different aspects of Indian culture and different languages. But on the whole, even though it's not stylistically or artistically all that bold, I think the performances are strong and the message that it attempts to convey is deft enough.
The film is Fire in the Mountains, Indian drama, directed and written by Ajit Pal Singh. It's unrated and it's at select Lemley theaters. The Janes is a documentary on HBO about a safe house and a group which provided safe underground abortions in the pre-Roe v. Wade era. The film is directed by Tia Lesson and Emma Pilds. Christy, what'd you think of The Janes?
It's so good, and it is unfortunately more timely and relevant than ever. This was not that long ago, and this threat of not being able to get an abortion now seems to be rising once again. But this is about the Jane Collective in the late 60s, early 70s in Chicago. These women are also the subject of a feature film that played at Sundance and is going to be coming out in October called Call Jane, starring Elizabeth Banks and Sigourney Weaver. But for now, we have it in documentary form, and we have interviews with these women who helped thousands and thousands of young women get abortions in Chicago. And it was still illegal then. As you mentioned, this is 1972 when all this comes about, before Roe versus Wade. And it is about their bravery and their resourcefulness and their ingenuity in finding a way to help as many women as it possibly could, knowing that it was illegal, knowing they could be put in jail for this, knowing just how dangerous it was, but recognizing it is even more dangerous for women to try to take care of it themselves or go to somebody who is disreputable and possibly injure themselves or worse. And so it's sort of it's got some spy thriller elements to it in that these women operated with code names and, you know, going from one address to another, and there's a front room and then there's a back room and people didn't know where they were going. And there were note cards with, you know, the most intimate details of strangers that they wanted to help. A lot of these women perhaps had gotten an abortion themselves and they knew how frightening it is and how alone you can feel. And they wanted to be there and really listen for these other women, or perhaps they were just sympathetic to what they were going through. But the interviews are really vivid and the archival footage really brings you back to this time. And it is unexpectedly funny at times and very informative and harrowing and heartbreaking. But I am so glad this movie exists to remind people of what this was like and hopefully what this will not be like again.
The film is The Janes, a documentary from directors Tia Lesson and M. Pilt. Now, it doesn't look like this is actually available on HBO or streaming for about a week and a half. What leads us to do it this week, Christy?
It's just extremely timely. It's you know, something that has been in the news, you know, because of this leaked Supreme Court opinion, which supposedly is coming out that would effectively overturn Roe v. Wade. And so the time to talk about this is now.
The film, again, is starting on June 8th, about a week and a half on both HBO and HBO Max streaming service. It's rated TVMA. The documentary We Feed People is on Disney Plus, directed by Ron Howard, and it focuses on celebrity chef and humanitarian Jose Andres. Christy.
This is a celebration of Chef Jose Andres and all of the incredible work that he does through his World Central Kitchen. And it follows him intimately. Ron Howard directed this. It follows him intimately as he jumps into whatever crisis zone arises and just mobilizes chefs he knows, people who are good with this kind of humanitarian work, to get people fed if there is a hurricane, if there is flooding, if there is a massive earthquake, more recently in the last couple of years, gone to places where, you know, families are devastated by COVID and can't get out and can't get, you know, groceries. He was going out and feeding people. And so you see the massive logistical undertaking that requires to do this, because he's trying to set up a kitchen in a disaster zone, you know, and people from all over, chefs want to help, you know, whether they have food trucks, whether they have a restaurant of their own that has been decimated. They want, everybody wants to chip in and help. And so it's really inspiring. It's in no way like a warts and all depiction of Jose Andres. I mean, there is exactly one scene in which you see him berating one of his volunteers because they give a woman a sandwich in the Bahamas, like before they've set up the whole table to make it more organized to distribute food to people who need it. Like, she walks up, she's hungry, he gives her a sandwich, and Jose Andres just goes off on him and later apologizes profusely. But you see the toll that it takes on him, on his family. They interview his wife and his three daughters, but it's pretty much universally singing the praise for this man who it does incredible work and puts himself in danger for others all the time.
We Feed People, the documentary on Disney Plus. Wade.
Yeah, I think I liked it less. I respect a lot of it. I mean, Jose Andres is definitely someone who is worth a profile. What he does is extraordinary, and how he does it is fascinating. I just don't know that there's enough story here. This film, I think, kind of limps into its, you know, almost gets to about 90 minutes, just barely. And it's very repetitive already halfway through. Sort of the same things keep happening over and over and over. They're interesting things, but I don't know that there's enough here to really, really sustain a feature-length film. Ron Howard is a superb storyteller, and he can make great documentaries. His Pavarotti documentary is magnificent. But you're only as good a storyteller as the story that you have. And I don't know that there's enough story yet in the life of Jose Andres. I think the third act or the fourth act of his efforts has yet to be written. So, you know, this might have been better as a 45-minute piece.
Ron Howard with a terrific documentary, by the way, about the town of Paradise, with extraordinary footage as people evacuated through walls of flames to try and escape that mountain town as it was destroyed by fire. This new documentary, We Feed People, directed by Howard, it's rated PG-13 and it's streaming on Disney Plus. Let's at least get started with 18 and a Half, which is a thriller directed by Dan Mirvish, who co-wrote the film with Daniel Moya. Wade?
Yeah, Dan Mirvish, co-founder of Slam Dance. So he knows this territory well. He's a very capable, low-budget filmmaker. And when you're doing a period film on a low budget, it's even more challenging. People should not expect this to be a Watergate film. 18 and a half, the title comes from the 18 and a half missing minutes on Nixon's tapes. And it's about a transcriber who works for the White House who comes up with the 18 and a half missing minutes and wants to leak it to the press and winds up kind of going into this this very strange detour that takes her, that makes it almost impossible to even find a machine to play the tape. And it's a little bit of a dark comedy. It's a little bit of a social commentary on the things that we prioritize and how politics can infect our everyday average lives and how small things can derail big things. I mean, it's got a lot on its mind for a small film with a small cast. But if you can get into the groove of its certain unique eccentricity, I think it's quite an impressive little tiny gem.
We're talking about Dan Mirvish's film 18 and a Half. We'll hear what Christy has to say about it when we continue on Film Week on KPCC.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. We remind you, if you tuned in a bit late, you missed what our critics had to say about the Top Gun sequel arriving more than three decades after the original. You haven't missed out. All you need to do is listen to the full hour of Film Week wherever you get your podcasts. Go to kpcc.org or tell your smart speaker to play Film Week. I'm joined by critics Christy Lemire, Wade Major, and Charles Solomon. We're in the midst of reviewing Dan Mirvish's thriller 18 and a Half, the film starring Willa Fitzgerald, John Magaro, and Vondi Curtis Hall. Christy, what did you think of it?
I like this. This is weird and small and unexpected, and it keeps changing as it goes along, and it kind of pulls off some tough tonal balances quite well. It's got a dreamlike kind of vibe to it from the very beginning, but then increasingly surreal things happen as it goes along. I really like Willa Fitzgerald in this, and she's got like a Rachel McAdams thing going, where she is like calm and still and sharp and smart in the midst of chaos. And it's tough to do that, to be like the center of a bunch of, you know, bizarre figures all around you. But she's got a great presence about her and sort of a similar comic timing to her. Yeah, you just never really know where this is going. And of course, it's a total fantasy as far as what happened with these 18 and a half minutes of Nixon tape. But I was amused.
18 and a half is unrated. You can see it at the Lemley Monica Film Center, and then it expands to multiple Lemley theaters starting next week. Zero Contact, a mystery thriller starring Anthony Hopkins, Chris Brochu, and Alex Panovic. The film is directed by Rick Dugdale and written by Cam Cannon. Wade, what'd you think of Zero Contact?
Worst Zoom meeting ever. There's a bit of a gimmick here, which is that they made this film during lockdown, and everyone, hence the title, no one had contact with anyone else during the film. Everyone was completely isolated. So all the actors are doing their parts through their cell phones in their own homes. The director is in his house. He's directing everyone by cell phone and by Zoom. So this entire movie was shot remotely and then posted remotely. So they're kind of proud of that fact. That's as much as they should be really proud, because it's really not that good. The idea is that Anthony Hopkins is this kind of this mythical tech figure who orchestrated some kind of, you know, a giant step in the surveillance state. And now all these people who have inherited his company, they're wondering what's going on. Someone's out to kill us. You know, what are we hiding? And there's a conspiracy here that doesn't really make sense. And a lot of it has to do with this very strange black clad digital figure who's breaking into everyone's house and killing them while they're all on this closed Zoom meeting. And it ultimately doesn't really amount to much of anything. It's a trick. It's a gimmick. It's let's see if we can make a movie that consists entirely of surveillance footage and cell camera footage with no one actually ever being in the same place at the same time. They pull that off, but does it go anywhere particularly interesting? Not really.
Is it supposed to be allegorical or literal?
No, it's a thriller. It's almost like a found footage movie. It's trying to sort of take a particular format, a way of engaging with visual material that we don't usually associate with narrative filmmaking, and turn it into narrative filmmaking, a little bit like what Blair Witch tried to do with just, you know, what you shoot on your camcorder. So, I mean, it's a trick. I give them props for trying something. You know, most people don't try anything new. They're trying something new here. I just don't think it goes anywhere very interesting.
It's at the Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills and available on demand for home viewing, Zero Contact. A Taste of Whale, a French documentary. The film is directed by Vincent Kellner. Christy.
This is incredibly hard to watch. This is really graphic and really violent and really bloody. And so just warning you off the top, this is a topic that is hard to explore and they don't shy away from it. It is about the traditional pilot whale slaughter that has gone on for centuries in the Faroe Islands, way, way up in the far North Atlantic between Norway and Iceland. They are a part of the Kingdom of Denmark, but they are their own entity under themselves with their own government. And so for centuries, they have lured pilot whales into this cove, and everyone goes down and they've got their weapons and they slice them to bits. And then they cut up the meat and distribute it to all the families. And parents bring their kids down. And, you know, every year they have these festivals where they celebrate this ritual and traditional dress and song and food. And it's really, really hard to watch. And so they are up there in this incredibly remote, insular place. They think minding their own business, doing what they have always done, doing what they think is the right thing to do as far as their culture. And this group of activists comes to try and stop them. This is a lot like the movie Blackfish, which was also about the killing of whales in Japan. And so, you know, these people are hardy and they have been there forever and it's tight knit and they don't want interlopers coming in and telling them how they should and should not live their lives. You know what side the filmmakers are on, obviously. But they do, I will to their credit say that they do try to give these people the space to explain themselves and explain why this matters. And they're not entirely villainous. They are humanized somewhat. But it is incredibly hard to watch, like kids playing on the whale carcasses. Anyway, not for everyone.
A Taste of Whale, Charles.
I did not much like this film. I mean, Christy's right. The subject is very difficult. But on one hand, you have the Faroese, who are ferociously independent and proud of their culture. And you have a group of very self-righteous, very judgmental French activists, one of whose leaders is Pamela Anderson. So you know you're not going to get a Susan Sontag kind of discussion out of this, who are telling them they're butchers and monsters. The Faroese reply, this is our tradition, that we are very involved in where our food comes from. We see that our children know that, whether it's seabirds or sheep or fish or pilot whales. Instead of trying to really discuss this and say, well, this tradition arose before we discovered that these animals are extremely intelligent and social And many people now find it inappropriate to eat them, myself among those people. They lecture and they're very self-righteous, although they go out, they get stranded in one of the bays and the Faroese have to rescue them. The real solution to this seems to be that a Faroese doctor discovers that the sea has become so polluted, the pilot whale meat is loaded with mercury to the point where it couldn't be sold anywhere. It has like 100 times as much mercury as codfish, and that it's dangerous to eat more than about 200 grams of it a month. So it's something that will have to be phased out for the safety and the health of the Faroese. But the documentarian feels, well, for one thing, the film is slow. The Faroese Islands are apparently gorgeous, and we get lots of slow camera shots of them. But it's, again, it's just too obvious, I think, that the position the filmmakers are taking, and it's just not very satisfying as a film.
A Taste of Whale documentary directed by Vincent Kellner. It's unrated. It's available on demand for home viewing and will be on DVD in the next few days. Wade, you want to just give us a brief, like 30 seconds on There Are No Saints, a.k.a. The Jesuit.
Yeah, this is kind of like a low-budget cut-rate version of a John Wick movie. Jose Maria Yazbek plays a hitman, a Mexican-American hitman who's released prematurely from prison on kind of a technicality. A law enforcement officer admits that he lied during the trial. So he gets out and he gets to go on a revenge rampage because he was wrongly imprisoned, and his son gets kidnapped in the middle of this. And if it didn't have people like Tim Roth and Neil McDonough and Ron Perlman, and if it didn't have a screenplay by Paul Schrader, I don't know that anybody would pay attention to it. It's pretty straightforward, kind of standard issue genre stuff. But, you know, it's got some names, and Paul Schrader's name is on the screenplay, and I guess that's worth something for somebody.
There Are No Saints, a.k.a. The Jesuit, directed by Alfonso Pineda Ulloa. The film is at the Galaxy Theaters Mission Grove in Riverside and available on demand. It's rated R. Coming up, we remember the late actor Ray Liotta, who died Thursday. It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. We remind you the Film Week podcast, extremely popular wherever you get your audio to listen to the entirety of the program. Joined this week by critics Charles Solomon, Wade Major, and Christy Lemire. Ray Liotta, best known for his leading role in Martin Scorsese's mob classic Goodfellas, died in his sleep Thursday while filming a movie in the Dominican Republic. He was 67 years of age. And let's listen back to Liotta in, this is from Goodfellas, from the final scene.
Mr. Hill, do you also know a man by the name of Paul Cicero?
Yes.
Do you see him here in the courtroom today?
Yes.
Can you point him out for the members of the jury? Your Honor, let the record reflect that Mr. Hill has identified the defendant, Paul Cicero. Your Honor, I have a document that I'd like to have marked.
See, the hardest thing for me was leaving the life. I still love the life. And we were treated like movie stars with muscle. We had it all just for the asking. Our wives, mothers, kids, everybody rode along. I had paper bags filled with jewelry stashed in the kitchen. I had a sugar bowl full of coke next to the bed.
People call them rats because a rat will do anything to survive. Isn't that right, Mr. Hill?
Objection.
Objection sustained.
Look, I don't know nothing about being a rat.
Mr. Hill, you know everything about being a rat.
Objection, Your Honor. In view of the violence...
Anything I wanted was a phone call away. Free cars, the keys to a dozen hideout flats all over the city. I'd bet 20, 30 grand over a weekend, and then I'd either blow the winnings in a week or go to the Sharks to pay back the bookies.
Didn't matter. Didn't mean anything. When I was broke, I would go out and rob some more. We ran everything. We paid off cops, we paid off lawyers, we paid off judges. Everybody had their hands out. Everything was for the taking. And now it's all over.
Ray Liotta, that in the final scene of Goodfellas, he played real-life American mobster Henry Hill. And he acted in a number of other major projects, Field of Dreams. He was Shoeless Joe Jackson in that film. He was Something Wild from Jonathan Demme, Dominic and Eugene. Quite recently, The Many Saints of Newark, which was the Sopranos-related film. Let me start with you, Christy. Your thoughts about Liotta?
Oh, it's just tragic. Oh, he just had such a fantastic and fascinating screen presence about him, because no matter what movie he was in, and he was in a wide range of movies, it had a wide range of abilities, he brought this thing, this incredibly magnetic presence where he was charming and charismatic, but there was this unmistakable hint of danger to him. He could be suave and cool and smooth, but like percolating beneath there was this unpredictability that was just fascinating to watch, and you could not turn your eyes away. And that was true no matter what kind of film he was in. You look back at Something Wild, that whole movie changes when he arrives.
So true.
And that's in this, and that's in the script, but that's his presence. He brings a danger to it that is really, really like startling and alive. Of course, Goodfellas was huge for him. And he was reluctant for a long time to do other kinds of mob movies, and understandably so. But then when he gets to one of his last roles, as you mentioned, The Many Saints of Newark, he's like this calm presence as the elder statesman opposite Alessandro Nivola. And he's so fantastic in that. He's so great in Marriage Story as Adam Driver's divorce lawyer.
Oh, like, yeah, I forgot about that.
So good. Again, like yes, the charisma and the swagger. And he always brought something unexpected no matter what. So I'm just really sad. This is heartbreaking.
Wade.
Yeah, it's a shock and it's a loss. He was one of those actors who was always incredibly comfortable in his skin, so much so that he was unafraid to play himself and even make fun of himself. Some people may, you know, it's easy to overlook his television work. He played himself in a couple episodes of Just Shoot Me, where he was so obsessed with Lara San Giacomo's character in that he was willing to give up his career. And he took pot shots at himself in that. He made fun of his image, and it was so funny and so refreshing. And it showed a completely different, more vulnerable comedic side to that tough guy persona that he cultivated in the movies. And it takes a lot of confidence to be that kind of an actor. I love a lot of his more underrated roles. No Escape, this wonderful action film, kind of a twist, an island-based twist on Escape from New York concept. He's a Marine, you know, and he's on this island with all these crazies and life imprisonment. He's got to get off. Beautifully directed by Martin Campbell. That earned Martin Campbell all of his James Bond work. And it's only because Ray Liotta is so tremendous. Don't think of him as an action hero, but he is in that movie. So he was just so versatile, so comfortable in his skin. And, Something Wild, really, that was his only his second film. And he came out of that with a head of steam, and that just drove him right into every subsequent role, right up until Goodfellas.
We have some news in the world of theaters, and that is that the Landmark Theater's flagship Los Angeles location, the 12-screen Landmark Pico, has closed. But the Landmark company is actually taking over the Playhouse 7 theaters from Lemley in Pasadena. Now, that building had been sold, and I had read that it was going to be redeveloped. It wasn't clear there would be theaters there. But with the ArcLight Pasadena closed, thankfully it appears Landmark is taking over Lemley's Pasadena location. Wade, your thoughts on these big changes that we're seeing in local theaters?
Well, I think I'm thrilled, you know, at what Landmark is doing, that they are still really holding down a footprint in the area. I'm glad they're taking over the Playhouse theaters. I didn't know that. That's news to me. So that's a great thing. Charles Cohen, who's, you know, Cohen Media, owns the Landmark theaters. They have a great vertical integration between, you know, full disclosure, I've done audio commentaries in some of their DVDs and Blu-rays. It's a good company, and it's great that they have this pipeline as a distributor, that they have home video, they have a streaming platform, and they have theaters. So there's a richness to it that means that Landmark is a stable company. Losing the screens on the West Side is a real blow. We need more art house theaters on the West Side, not fewer, and losing all of those screens in the Landmark is tough. So I hope that those screens don't go away. I hope another company takes them over. But in terms of maintaining an art house presence here, I'd like to see Landmark find some other opportunity on the West Side.
The company says it's also going to revamp the Pasadena location and make multiple improvements to that facility, which is very dated. Also, we have James Gray, the writer-director, who was interviewed in the wake of his autobiographical film, Armageddon Time, debuting at the Cannes Film Festival. And Deadline, quoting him, you know, talking about the importance of art house type films, independent cinema, as a part of a broad portfolio for movie theaters and for the film industry. The studio shouldn't just be concerned with what a blockbuster can bring, but how these other films, even if they're not revenue generating, what they mean to keeping people coming to theaters to see movies. Christy, your thoughts about his point, which to me makes a lot of sense.
It's crucial at a time when, you know, you look at what's playing at your local AMC and it's like Top Gun 1,000 times a day, you know, or it's Doctor Strange 1,000 times a day, and those blockbusters tend to dominate. There's a series that we do on our Breakfast All Day YouTube called Movie House Shoutout, where we talk about art houses across the country, and a lot of them draw retirees and college students, because that's who often are in these college towns. And those are total vital and loyal and consistent movie-going audiences as well, who appreciate something that's a little more challenging,
so
that's
true,
beautifully made, that needs to be seen on a screen.
For our critics, I'm Larry Mantle. Thanks so much for joining us on this edition of Film Week.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.